Well, wait a minute. I just forgot something. When I hold that up to you and you say, well, you know, that's what you looked like 2.5 million years ago. And you say, well, no, I didn't look like that. But the more you look at that thing, now you look at it. Now, the more you look at it, you begin to scratch your head. You know, I've seen that guy somewhere before. You know, I've seen him somewhere before. Maybe down there at the state legislature. Maybe he was over in the governor's mansion. Then you said, light dawned. You said, I know who that is. That's a Louisiana politician. He's got a small brain and a big mouth. Where's the missing link? Now, you tell me, where's that missing link? Maybe it's right there. That's the missing link. Where's that missing link? Is that not a system, an evolutionary system standing in outer space? If not, no. What is it? You're standing looking at it. You know, you got to come to grips with that. You say, well, I don't believe that. That's fine. You know, you don't have to believe it. But there it is. You know, it doesn't matter. You say, I don't believe it. There it is. So what does it mean? You know, you've got to come to grips. You've got to understand it. You've got to figure out, well, what in the world does that mean? The fact that I go all the way back to the Australopithecine. What it means is something magnificent. What it means is that's our story right there, you see. Well, let me add a little bit more to that story. Let me turn my page first before I get on to the other part of the story. All right, now so far, really, we've defined the primate, we've defined the human as a primate that walks erect. See, if we look at all these, figure out what's common among all of these is that we're a member of the primate order, you know, like chimpanzees, gorillas, baboons, and so forth, but we're different from them in that we walk erect. So a human is a primate that walks erect. You could say he's an ape that walks erect, but that wouldn't be right. That's not the correct way of doing it. Apes do things differently. And we're a primate that walks erect. Now, are you satisfied with that definition of who you are? Is that who you are? Just a primate that walks erect? I tell you, I do more things than that. I do more things than just walking around. What other factor might come in here to account for, to help us to understand evolution? Tell you, that other factor is the capacity to dream. To dream, not only to dream, but to turn those dreams into reality. Well, what's the evolutionary record of that? We've got it, I'll tell you. Let's start out with the first dream. Here we are. That's a pebble tool made by Australopithecus. And you say, well, that's not much of a dream. It looks like a nightmare to me. But but the more you look at it, and Dr. Geisler, he's good on these, you know, forms that have intelligence behind them, and he'll tell you that's an intelligence made that. And what you're looking at is a dream that's come true. You know, the Australopithecines got together, and there's something happening in their heads, you know. They're having these visions. And some of you ought to know about visions, I tell you. But that's these dreams in their head, you know, and they're trying to talk to one another about these dreams, what it is that they see. You know, they're seeing something, they're seeing a tool in this rock. There's a rock laying out there, and they're seeing a tool in that rock, and they talk about it, and they discuss it, you know, in the way, best way that they can. And then one of them reaches out with his hand, gets that rock there, and he starts chipping away at it to make that rock like that dream. And the others say, yeah, that's the way to do it. And together, they turn their dreams into reality. That's being human. All right, let's see what happens to a dream. They're going up to Homo erectus. We see a different kind of tool. You know, the old Australopithecus banging away at that rock. You know, his dreams weren't all that complete, or his hands weren't working too well. But looky here. You know, that would look a lot better, too, right there. So something's happened to our dream. We're beginning to be able to dream better and to coordinate our actions with our dreams. We're beginning to pool our ideas better and to come up with better tools. All right, going up to Neanderthal, dreams get even better. Here's another tool. It's a lot finer made. It's got more symmetry to it. So
something, the Neanderthal is dreaming even better, and he's turning those dreams into reality.
All right, finally, come on up to 12 magazine, man. If I find it, it's somewhere. There it is.
And we find just a perfect, perfect two. Now look at that. That's got symmetry that way. That's got symmetry that way. That's a real delicate instrument. So this is the result of the dreams that they're having among themselves. The dreams they've had in the past. The dreams that they're looking ahead and molding those dreams to fit that, to make that dream come true, to extract out of that rock that two. And so that's what... The capacity to walk upright is one of our attributes, Certainly it is. It's an important attribute. This other attribute, the capacity to dream, the capacity to symbolize and turn those symbols into reality, that's another attribute. We can dream someday about going to the moon. And damn me if we didn't do it. Now, ain't that magnificent? Tell me, that's good, isn't it? All right, here's that story starts with Australopithecus and come all the way up to landing on the moon. We started out in the African savannah 2.5, 3 million years ago, and we've come a long way. And where are we going to go next? What we're looking at is a story of becoming, a story of being, a story of march of mankind from the African savannah to Tranquility Base. This is my story. It's your story. It's Dr. Geisler's story. It's the story of us all. It's the story of the human species. Thank you.
Let me first of all respond by pointing out that the creationist argument and the total picture has to do with the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of new life forms, and the origin of man. And of course, we did not hear any response to the origin of universe argument or the origin of life argument, or for that matter, the origin of the thousands and thousands of new life forms. We heard only a presentation with regard to the origin of man. So I assume those other arguments are valid because they were not refuted. Secondly, let me point out that the facts on the table there are not as clear-cut facts as one would surmise. For example, presentations like this have long existed in biology and anthropology textbooks, which included people like Piltdown Man. 350-some doctoral dissertations were written on Piltdown Man. People got PhDs for that, which simply means phenomenally dumb, because Piltdown turned out to be a fraud, a total hoax, but he was once paraded with evidence like this. Nebraska Man was once used in illustrations like this. That turned out to be an extinct pig's tooth. So you have to take, not with a grain of salt, but a barrel of salt, some of the things that you hear anthropologists tell you. Let me also point out that a series like this, even if you could prove that every one of these actually existed and that they were ancestrally related, which of course now evolutionists have generally given up with regard to the horse, that's not an ancestrally related series, so that is vanishing from most textbooks. Many anthropologists disagree that this is an ancestrally related series. Many agree that there are modern type men earlier than some of these later, so there's a mixture of it. It's not quite as factual as it may look when you line them up on the table. But even granting their wildest imagination, granting the billions of years, granting that these were all found in sequence, granting that they were finally graded series, you could line up automobiles and do the same thing. Would that prove that one evolved from the other? You could line up the canning kettle, small kettles, down to a teaspoon in your kitchen. Would that prove the canning kettle evolved from a teaspoon? What they have to show is that there is some mechanism, some mode, some natural process that can produce 20 million volumes worth of complex information from one little volume. There is no natural law known to man that can produce that. All the similarity of skulls will do absolutely nothing. To say that evolutionists agree, or to imply that they agree on these matters, is not at all the case. For example, let me quote some evolutionists with regard to Australopithecus. They say, morphology, or shape of the teeth, in many features is more man-like, but all of these animals possess small brains, the cranial capacity averaging 500 cc's or less, about one-third of that for modern man. Both of them had ape-like skulls and jaws. In fact, Lord Zuckerman's conclusion, he spent 15 years of research on this. Although most studies emphasize the similarity of Australopithecines to modern man and suggest, therefore, that these characteristics were bipedal toolmakers, at least one form of which was this, he denies this and suggests that what we are looking at here is Ashley Montague, the great anthropologist, said, the skull form of Australopithecines is extremely ape-like and shows too many specialized and ape-like characteristics to be the direct ancestor of man or the line of descent that came to man. Neanderthal was man. Cro-Magnon was man. Those are human. But they had religious activity. They had God consciousness. They had evidence of culture. But when you get to jawbones, teeth, fragmentary evidence, wild guesses about age, disagreement among anthropologists, revisions of textbooks, throwing out frauds, you can't call that factual. That's hypothetical. That's speculative. That's a guessing game, and it in no way invalidates the arguments in favor of an intelligent creator of the first living thing of the universe and of every other living thing that emerged on the scene after that. Small changes over a long period of time do not prove evolution, because time plus chance plus natural laws never produces greater specified complexity. Go up in an airplane, drop colored paper out at 10,000 feet. What are the chances that it'll form your name on your roof? Slim. You say, we need more time. Go up 20,000 feet and drop it out. What will happen? It will be more mixed. Go up 10 miles and drop it. It'll be more random. What the evolutionist needs to show is that apart from intelligent intervention, you can produce more information, more complex, specified complexity of greater nature over a long period of time by purely natural laws. That they haven't done. But creationists can show how an intelligent being can put alphabet cereal together into a message, how an intelligent being can write drink Coke in the sky. Say, well, you've never seen a tree maker. You have seen a watchmaker. Carl Sagan has never seen extraterrestrial intelligence. But when he gets the first message from outer space, he'll believe that it's there. I've never seen an ancient Egyptian, but I just saw the pyramids a couple weeks ago and the Sphinx, and that is enough evidence to indicate there were intelligent beings there. Though we have never seen the original creator of the universe, neither have evolutionists seen the original natural process that they posit for it. Both of us are engaging not in empirical science, we're engaging in forensic science. We are reconstructing the past built on the evidence in the present. The unobserved events of the past are reconstructed in the light of the best evidence. The best evidence says that it always takes an intelligent being to produce specified complexity. That's creation, not evolution. Thank you.
We invite you to stay now for a very brief question and answer time. We won't go any longer than 30 minutes, but some of you do have some questions. I have some of those here. You may have some other questions that were raised. Write them down, pass them forward, and we'll try to address, if we do get some more, as many as possible this evening. Both of our guests have agreed that they will have a maximum of 2 minutes, and each of them will be given the opportunity to answer every question. The first question that I have here is addressed specifically to Dr. Geisler, and of course Dr. Richardson will have an opportunity to respond if he cares to. Dr. Geisler, when you say that everything must have a cause in science, that's fine. What you fail to realize is that you must explain now scientifically God's existence.
The principle of causality simply says that every event has an adequate cause. The principle of uniformity says that we should posit the same kinds of causes that we see producing that event in the present regularly in the past when we don't see it. So, for example, if we see things like the Grand Canyon being produced in the present, then we can posit a natural cause for them in the past. If we see things like Mount Rushmore coming from intelligent causes in the present, then we should posit an intelligent cause for something like that in the past. As a scientist, that's as far as you go. I did not quote from the Bible. I did not describe the nature of this God other than it was a powerful, intelligent being. And I did not imply any kind of act of worship toward it. As a scientist, you simply go where the evidence leads. And if the evidence leads to an intelligent cause, archaeologists looking at an archaeological artifact, say, for example, an arrowhead, then all of our previous experience tells us that we need an intelligent cause for the arrowhead and not river, water, or some kind of wind erosion to account for it. So from a strictly scientific point of view, we're acting as a forensic scientist using the evidence in the present to reconstruct the likely cause in the past. If you have a beginning of the universe, then obviously the only likely cause is something beyond the universe, and if the universe is the natural system, then the likely cause will be a supranatural cause. And if you have highly complex information like in the first living thing, the only likely cause is an intelligent one, so then you posit an intelligent supernatural cause for the universe and living things. That's as far as we go as scientists.
We'll move on to the next question that has to do... Some of us are familiar with this evidence, Dr. Richardson, and perhaps you can address this question. Is there scientific evidence that the footprints of dinosaurs and the footprints of men exist in the same rock layer, and does that have any influence on the topic that we're debating this evening?
The question is there scientific evidence for dinosaur footprints and human footprints occurring at the same time? Of course, the answer is no. There's no scientific evidence at all to that effect. What the question refers to, though, is a site in Texas. It's called Dinosaur Park in the vernacular, and it certainly there's lots of evidence there of dinosaur tracks But the so-called human tracks that some people have claimed to be there bear very little resemblance to the human foot at all. So, in a very brief way, there's no scientific evidence that dinosaurs and humans were together at one time.
Dr. Geisler, do you care to respond to that?
I've been to the Paluxy River. I have not seen anything there that would convince a skeptic that there were human footprints along with the dinosaur footprints. But I will say this. There was some kind of bipedal animal that left human-like footprints there that do cross dinosaur footprints. And the evidence for that is just as good as the evidence for Leakey's footprints in Africa. In other words, the distinctiveness of the footprint is just as great in one case as the other. And evolutionists will use Leakey's footprints as an argument that there was a half ape, half man, but they will not allow the other evidence to apply in favor of the simultaneity of dinosaurs and humans. I don't think that's arguing reasonably or fairly. Furthermore, the same evolutionists will say this. Alongside of the so-called human footprints in Africa, there were footprints of, let's say, elephants. footprints of giraffes, and an evolutionist will say the giraffe footprint was a proof that it was a giraffe, 100%. The elephant footprint was a proof that 100% elephant lived there. But the human footprint was a proof that it was half human and half ape.
There are a number of questions here which deal specifically with the problem of can a Christian be an evolutionist, can an atheist, what beliefs are available, what options are available. I'm going to choose one question from that will summarize, I think, most of your questions that I have in front of me now. This is from one of our professors here at LSU in the Religious Studies program that's housed in our Department of Philosophy. There's similar questions to both of our guests today. First of all, Dr. Geisler, what if somehow you became persuaded that evolution was true? Would you then have to stop believing in God? Or could you rethink your concept of God to incorporate this new perspective?
As we indicated on one of our early slides, there are two views with regard to natural law explanations. One, that God created the natural laws and the natural laws explain the origins. The other, that there was no God to create the natural laws, but they explain the origins. One is called theistic and one is called non-theistic evolution. As I indicated in my first presentation, you could be a theistic evolutionist. My own position with regard to theistic evolution is this. It is theoretically possible, scientifically improbable, and biblically untenable. So as a philosopher, I can say, yes, it's theoretically possible. There was a God who created these natural laws and did it. As a scientist, I can say, but when I look at the evidence, I don't see evidence that these natural laws did it. And as a Christian theologian, I can look at the scripture and say, from the standpoint of the Bible, it says he didn't. So theistic evolution is philosophically possible, scientifically improbable, and biblically untenable.
Dr. Richardson, a corollary question of that is there are a couple of questions up here that ask about, we know Dr. Geisler's religious background. They're asking about your religious background. I think that can be best summarized in the question again. What is your best case for evolution? And beyond that, what if you were to become persuaded that such a theory of evolution did not account for all factors? Where would you turn? This is...
There's two parts to the question, two questions. What's the best evidence for the presence of evolution? You're looking at it right there. You know, there it is, staring you in the face. There's lots of other evidence, but that's the evolution. The evidence for human evolution is right there. Now, what was the second part? I'm sorry.
What if you were to be persuaded that such a theory of evolution didn't account for all the factors?
All right. Those are the facts. If they come up with a different interpretation of those facts, well, you know, if I'm going to be a scientist, I have to come up with a different interpretation. Those are the facts. Whatever interpretation best explains those facts, you know, that's the interpretation we'll work with. Now, you've got to keep in mind that interpretation in theory in science is an ongoing matter. You know, it's not something frozen in concrete. We're constantly arguing this, that, and another. And creationists hear us arguing among themselves, and they say, well, you know, creationists don't argue like that. Those scientists just argue around and around and around. They must not know what they're talking about. But see, that's mistaking discussion and exploration for confusion.
Okay, another question for you. We'll go to you and ask Dr. Geisler to answer this. As creationist, Dr. Richardson, has creationist criticism of science or of anthropology resulted in a more careful assessment of evidence and more conservative claims by evolutionary biologists?
No, not at all.
Okay. Just let me turn that to you.
One of the reasons for that honest answer is that evolutionists distinguish, as Dr. Richardson did earlier, between evolution as a fact and evolution as a means or process. And they say often, as Carl Sagan did in Cosmos, evolution is not a theory, it's a fact. But the sense in which evolution is a fact is only microevolution that's observable in the present. Macroevolution from the past is not a fact, that's a pure theory. And many evolutionists call it a hypothesis, some even a myth, and some even faith. So when you're talking about macroevolutionary changes in the past that nobody observed and that are not being repeated in the present, we're not talking about facts, we're talking about theories, and those have to be subject to change. And to say that evolution is a fact in the sense of macroevolution is an arrogant claim that some evolutionists make. In fact, I was at the Arkansas trial, creation evolution trial, and one of the evolutionists on the stand said, he was asked, do you believe evolution is a fact? He said, yes. Do you believe that all scientific theories should be tentative, which is how they define scientific theories as one of the characteristics? He said, yes. And the cross-examining attorney said, could you explain to the court what a tentative fact is?
I'm going to combine a couple of your questions here. These are directed, first of all, to Dr. Geisler, specifically to Dr. Geisler. I'll read both of these to you. Your whole argument for creationism is based on disproving evolution. This does not prove creationism. There could be another reason. What facts do you have to prove creationism without disproving evolution? Going along with that, another student wrote, I want to believe in creationism, but there is really no proof. Doesn't the beginning of the earth, according to the Bible, i.e. Adam and Eve, and the time of apes overlap?
With regard to the first question, it is true that some creationists appear to argue, and I think fallaciously, that either evolution is true or creation. Evolution is not true, therefore creation. I think this is not a good argument, and it's not the one that I presented. The one that I presented was that every event must have an adequate cause. The kinds of causes we see in the present to regularly produce events must be the ones posited in the past. So the evidence is positive. There's positive evidence that specified complexity is produced by intelligent beings. You can do it any time you want to blow a fan on your alphabet cereal. You can do it any time you want to drop paper out of the sky. So the evidence is the principle of regularity, which is the basis for positing the same kinds of causes in the past. Whereas evolution has no explanation built in present regular processes that can account for this kind of thing. They finally end up saying, sure, it's highly improbable, sure, it's virtually impossible, but it did happen. That led Sir Fred Hoyle, who was an atheist, in his book Evolution from Space, to say, yes, the chances for evolution of life occurring on Earth by pure chance alone are 1 in 10 to the 40,000th power. Now, 10 to the 40,000th power, more atoms than there are in the whole universe. So that's not like finding a needle in a haystack. That's like finding one atom in the whole universe. To which, of course, an evolutionist responds, but it could have happened. To which we respond, but that's building your argument on luck and chance, not on regularly known processes such as I built the argument for creation.
Dr. Richardson, a question directed to you. We've heard an awful lot in recent years about the dating devices, the processes that are used to date artifacts. How accurate are these dating devices, in your opinion?
Well, they're accurate enough to find oil, you know, in the ground. They're the same techniques that are used to date fossils that are used to date appropriate strata in the earth so that geologists know to drill down to that strata to get the oil. So that's as accurate, I think, as perhaps they need to be. They're bad geologists.
Sure. The dating devices, you care to respond to that?
I might point out that although there are two kinds of creationists, those who hold an old earth and those who hold a young earth. I happen to be an old earth creationist and agree that the universe is probably billions of years old. However, in defense of those who are young earth creationists, I'll point out that there are just as good a geologist who believe and can find oil wells who believe that the universe is only thousands of years old. And in their defense, I'll say one other thing. Dr. Donald Chittick, PhD in chemistry, invented a fossil fuel for one-third the price of gasoline. He was sworn in as an expert witness in Arkansas. No one challenged his invention. His invention is built on a young Earth model. Rather than coal building up over thousands of years from decaying vegetation, he hypothesized that it built up in short periods by chemical action because he'd see a wooden pillar in a coal mine that within 10 years became coal. Couldn't have been there millions of years. And on that basis, he invented a fossil fuel that will power a car for one-third price of gasoline. I think unless the scientific community opens up and is willing to at least look at the evidence for both sides, young and old, evolution and creation, we're going to be hindering scientific...
a very narrow religious view in public schools. And I started off talking about freedom, you know. Why not one let very narrow, that's what you're asking, one narrow, very narrow perspective be taught in public schools? Why not let the astrologers come back and teach astrology? Why don't we kick out the astronomers? You know, tell astronomers, well, you got to give part-time to the astrology. Why don't we tell the chemists, well, you got to give part-time to alchemy.
At the risk of backing up and covering some more ground, this question, first of all, for Dr. Richardson. Do you find that, Dr. Richardson, theistic evolution can be a plausible humanistic view of the beginnings of man?
Well, that sounds a bit like a contradiction to me. Can theistic evolution be a plausible humanistic explanation? I don't think it could be. It couldn't be a plausible humanistic explanation because it's a theistic explanation. So, I guess my answer to the question is, no, I don't think it's a plausible arrangement.
What's the guy's question? Theistic evolution?
Let me add to what was said before about theistic evolution, commonly unknown fact that many of the early evolutionists, though some may have personally believed or wondered whether there was a God, did see their theory as directly opposed to God. Charles Darwin, for example, said this, "Belief in God, religion, there is no evidence that man was aboriginally endowed with the ennobling belief in the existence of an omnipotent God." Then he went on to say, "I speak of natural selection as an active power or deity." And one of the things that bothers many fair-minded, open-minded people is that you could teach those kind of theories in the public school which are directly intended to exclude God, but you can't teach any theories which are directly intended to include God. In fact, the co-founder of the principle of evolution, natural selection rather, was Alfred Wallace, and he said natural selection is supreme, and he defined it as a process that explained the whole universe. Now, if you can use evolution as a process to explain the whole universe and evolution to explain what God once explained, then why can't you, alongside of that, at least present the other point of view? Marx, who Charles Darwin wanted to introduce his book and dedicate it to Karl Marx, said this, "Nowadays, in our evolutionary conception of the universe, there is absolutely no room for either a creator or a ruler." And I would just simply appeal to your common sense and to your sense of fairness and ask you this. How can creationists be called narrow-minded when they're the ones that are arguing for teaching both views in the public schools, and the evolutionists be considered broad-minded when they want to teach only their view?
What Dr. Geisler is really asking is, why can't this narrow sectarian view be taught in public schools? Why can't religion be taught in public schools? Well, as we have separation of church and state, you know, we have a constitution which prohibits the teaching of narrow sectarian views in our public schools. I hope we will continue to follow our Constitution.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed this evening. There's a lot, many of you have more questions here. Our guests will be available after the end of the program this evening. Please feel free to come forward and meet them. On behalf of the Department of Philosophy and the chapel on the campus, thank you for your presence tonight.